Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. My name is Anisa Isak and you are listening to the Early Morning Sunday Show. We've come to basically the last segment of the show called Conscious Consumer with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the Economics and Finance Desk of the Jamaatul Ulama of South Africa. And we talk or try to make sense of all things finance. So inshallah we'll be hearing some very interesting things that we will be talking about and hopefully bring you some understanding, empowerment and education in the process. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, Aba Anisa and all our listeners of Radio Islam International.
Well, we're dealing with four things today and we're going to be starting off with cost of things undoubtedly influences behavior. Definitely, I think. So tell us a little bit more about why you chose this topic.
You know, the thing is, as a Muslim consumer or as a Muslim economic unit, ideally, the cost of things should not influence behavior. The driver of a Muslim consumer or Muslim economic unit's behavior is actually or should be the consciousness of Allah Ta'ala and one's level of closeness to deen or willingness to adhere to principles of deen in carrying out one's economic behavior or even managing one's financial life. So that is the ideal position, you know, in terms of where we should be and where we should strive to be in terms of gaining greater proximity to Allah Ta'ala and gaining greater consciousness of Allah Ta'ala so that that becomes the driving force behind our behavior and the conditioning effect of our behavior. Mm-hmm. With that said, the reality of things is that most times in the modern world, the cost of things is what actually influences behavior. So if I just take a simple example, like someone maybe recklessly driving a motor vehicle on the road, you know, if you deeply analyze that situation, you would inevitably find out that the person who is driving very recklessly, not being responsible on the road, is not actually the owner of the motor vehicle. It's possibly the case that maybe a parent or someone else owns the vehicle, and so the person is driving just as they feel like and going about their day. But that's purely because the individual is not having to bear the cost of the asset that is being driven around, and as a result of not being aware of what it costs to maintain that vehicle or to obtain it in the first place, that individual's behavior is now distorted and reflects something negative. But when that same individual suddenly becomes the owner of the motor vehicle, you know, let's assume that in the case of a child starting to maybe work and now purchase their own motor vehicle, suddenly behavior changes. So undoubtedly, the cost of things does influence our behavior, and many a time, even the ordinary consumer, if you just shift away from the example, we find that once we start paying our own bills, we become much more responsible in terms of managing our finances. Now, for today's discussion and in response to your question, I just want to say that with regard to motor vehicles, and this is where our consumers need to be educated and become more conscious, when it comes to motor vehicles specifically, there's a very recent survey that has come out regarding the pricing of motor vehicle parts. It's called the Kinsey Report. And this is a survey which is done by a Durban-based motoring guru called Malcolm Kinsey. He resources car part prices for selected vehicles, like from your very cheap vehicles to the premium brands. And every year, this survey produces some really jaw-dropping surprises in terms of prices of things. Now, what the survey does is that they group motor vehicle parts in three categories. The first category is service parts, like your spark plugs, oil filters, brake pads, and so forth. The second category is that of repair parts, like the cam belts, shocks, etc. And the third category is that of crash parts. So you have these three categories of parts, right? But many a time when it comes to service parts and repair parts, most ordinary consumers they don't realize the cost of these parts. And this is partly attributed to the fact that many a time the motor vehicle has a service plan or a maintenance plan. And so the ordinary consumer relies on these backup plans which come with purchasing the vehicle. And those plans sort of cover the cost of service parts or even repair parts. But the trash part is where many consumers don't actually consider the impact it can have on one's own personal finances. And I say this because sometimes crash parts, like your fenders, doors, bonnets, rims, light clusters, all of those parts are your crash parts. And those parts are sometimes so expensive that they can actually determine, they can influence your personal financial position in terms of maybe the excess you have to pay if you have the car full cover. Or even the premiums you pay monthly, and it also determines thirdly the right of point of your motor vehicle, and I'll explain how each of these things are affected. So let's take example where you're having to replace this crash part, which is very expensive now. And I must just add a context here, where many a time once we start being aware of the cost of these parts, we start changing our driving behavior, you know. But be that as it may, let me just go to the main point of education here for our consumers. The point is that when you have to subsidize the crash part, and you make a claim against the car full cover, the excess is what is the uninsured portion you have to pay when you make a claim. That excess is increased. So if you were paying, say 1,000 rand for your excess whenever you claim from your car full, suddenly now, because you claimed on a crash part, you would have to pay more in subsequent months. So that's how your excess could be affected by having to claim for expensive crash parts. And then you have the premium. The monthly premium will also go up for the subsequent months now, because when you do claim for any crash parts, and the crash parts are now expensive, you find that the monthly premium on your takaful suddenly goes up. And it's something that you have to now factor into in managing your personal financial position. And the third aspect is the aspect of how claiming for crash parts or having to replace crash parts can influence the right of point of a vehicle. Because sometimes a small part, let's just say a fender in the front is damaged, right? In this kind of scenario, if the value of the replacement is more than 70% of the value of the vehicle, it will be written off. And when I looked at the survey in detail, I found that sometimes some of the most smallest incidents and smallest, what we would regard as smaller than onlooker, is so expensive in some of the vehicles that it exceeds 70% of the vehicle value. And hence the vehicle is written off. Now your takaful pays you back, they reimburse you, but the value you get back is very often insufficient to replace your motor vehicle.
Yes.
This is why I think coming back to my main point, when we start to realize the cost of things, our behavior changes. And for purposes of the discussion I've just had now, I'm just looking at the cost of motor vehicle parts and how that alone can influence our driving behavior. And I hope that it's empowering to our consumers to understand how the cost of motor vehicle parts can actually influence your finances, firstly on the issue of the excess you pay on your takaful cover whenever you do claim.
Yeah.
It can also impact your premium monthly and also the right of point of the motor vehicle.
Well, it's certainly given me something to think about. So I'm sure that many people listening would feel the same way, because obviously your behavior is definitely affected by what's happening in your wallet.
Most definitely. Often then it's probably the only thing which conditions behavior in this day and age.
Yeah, I that's very, very true. Okay, that's very, very interesting to know. And I'm sure that it affects other parts of our lives as well. This is just one bit of that, you know, that we're looking at, and that is looking at car and, you know, with regards to the cost of parts and that kind of thing. But I'm sure that this has a broader impact on us, especially with regards to spending.
Most definitely. But just, you know, this is not the car program, so we're not looking at motoring issues, right? I'm just talking of how, just by way of example, but in general, you are very precise and on the point there, in the sense that the cost generally conditions behavior. And many a time, this is the kind of discussion that needs to be had with children who are growing up in a home.
Example,
orientate them around the cost of things, but at the same time, there has to be a balance, because as a parent, you do not want to convey or send out a signal of being miserly. You want to teach or impart lessons on how the things are becoming costly and sometimes not affordable, and sometimes the non-affordability is a reason for one having to abstain and stay away or be deprived of some specific privilege of day-to-day life.
I think we can take the electricity consumption as an example. In recent months, and we know that in the future, the cost of electricity in South Africa has been impacted because of what's happening with Eskom. So obviously, you know, when your mom's telling you, please switch the lights off if you're not using them, it has a huge impact because it could actually cut down on your electricity bill, which in turn means that you could get something else for that money that is saved, or it could go towards your saving. Or instead of our children complaining, but why do I have to switch the lights off every time? It's costing more to switch it off and on. You know, so that is one way that we can actually look at it as well, because I know that electricity costs, I've been looking at some of the conversations that take place, or listening to conversations that take place, as well as looking at some of the things that get said on WhatsApp groups and things like that with regards to electricity, where people had no idea that electricity increases over a period of time because of what's happening with Eskom. And they've seen these huge raises in their electricity bills, and are trying to figure out why this is happening, because their consumption has remained the same.
Yes. I think the point you raise is very valid here, in the sense that electricity is one of those examples where, as a user of the electricity, you'll find it difficult to quantify cost. So one is the cost in terms of the wallet, but in terms of what it takes to generate electricity, the measurement of electricity itself is often not known to people or not realized by people. And this is why we tend to overlook or overstep the mark in terms of how we behave. So, this concept of non-measurement is so vast in the sense that even when we calculate time, because time is not something that is tangible, we tend to often overlook that or factor time as a cost or any other intangible concept, which is also regarded as a cost. So even though one may be utilizing some privilege in today, basically, but in time to come, beyond one's own lifetime, there's a cost to that action today, because the future generation might be deprived of a specific privilege which we enjoy today.
No, absolutely. Well, we're looking also now at non-refundable deposits. Not something I commonly think about, but enlighten us on that.
Okay, you know, as consumers, at some point in our lives, we are likely to run into a situation where we are required to put down a non-refundable deposit, or even a deposit. Let's call it for now a deposit for any transaction to go forward. So youth may not be able to identify with the situation. Maybe to an extent, let's say someone at university or someone at school has put on a deposit for some textbook or some event or something of that sort. But later in life, maybe you're trying to book a venue or for a function, or you're trying to do some transaction which requires putting down of a deposit. Now, the whole issue is that we find in the South African context, fortunately, we have the Consumer Protection Act to regulate to some extent the aspect of non-refundable deposits. Now, let me state at the very outset that there's one area which is common between the Sharia and the modern-day Consumer Protection Act, and this is the fact that it is not allowed, it is illegal to have a completely non-refundable deposit policy. And this is very frequent. As a consumer, you go into a store and it's written very boldly, so you don't miss it, that no refund allowed. You know, that is refunds. Now, let's keep it confined to deposits itself. But when you put on the deposit, the policy is there's a tendency to have the deposit completely non-refundable. This aspect is illegal in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, as well as from a Sharia law perspective. So to have the deposit is completely non-refundable under any circumstance is illegal. What the Consumer Protection Act does allow for, and also the Sharia also allows for this year, is the aspect of a reasonable cancellation fee. Keeping in mind that even the Islamic law of commerce is about the upholding of rights, fulfilling of rights of other individuals in a transaction. Sometimes the vendor with whom a service is signed up for, that individual also has a cost that needs to be taken care of. So in the event of a cancellation, sometimes there's a valid case that can be made for having to retain a reasonable amount of the deposit that has been put down. So So that is why there is some leeway for having a deposit and maybe having to keep a reasonable fee back for in the event of cancellation. I must add that from a Sharia perspective, the whole issue boils down to the reason why the cancellation is being made. So, and this is an area which the CPA, I'm not aware of it being, touching on, is the aspect of sometimes you look at the reason. If the reason is legitimate, then from a Sharia perspective, a deposit is fully refundable. If the reason is not legitimate, then there's room for some kind of penalties to apply in terms of retaining that that deposit either entirely or even partially. There is some case to be made there. I think what's important to clarify is that when a person is a vendor, they should not view the taking of a deposit as a mechanism for enriching themselves. It is not that. It is purely to obtain some kind of certainty in the transaction and protection in the event that the consumer or the customer in the transaction is careful of their behavior in terms of canceling their contract. So I think it's an important aspect. It's just that many of us, when we enter into transactions, we often overlook this aspect of reading the terms and conditions. What does,
yes,
if I'm putting down the deposit, what does the deposit, what does the contract say regarding this deposit that I'm putting down? Those implications are often overlooked because we don't foresee the transaction going pear-shaped. We always just understand that things will be fine. We don't cater for the adverse scenario. And this goes with other aspects of life, whether it's planning a business, starting a new business. We just don't plan for the eventualities of the idea maybe going pear-shaped or not yes, going according to plan.
Uh-huh. Okay. With non-refundable deposits, can, you know, sometimes you find that there are lease agreements for rentals and things like that where the deposit is refundable, and it usually comes with a clause that says it will be invested to accrue interest. What happens, I know this has not got nothing to do with a non-refundable, but what happens in the case where, as a Muslim, you do not want that kind of scenario, you don't want the interest? Can you either accept the interest if the landlord gives it to you at the end of your lease period, if you are leaving, and maybe donate that? Or what can you maybe just have the landlord understand that you do not want that kind of scenario for yourself?
I thought the question is extremely valid and does often occur. The permutations of the specific question are numerous. Let's confine ourselves to the scenario where the tenant is Muslim and the landlord is non-Muslim. In this kind of scenario, if the lease agreement stipulates that the deposit will be invested and accrue interest, and I'm not sure if the contract will go as far as saying what will happen to the interest. I would assume that many a time the landlord would want to retain that interest rather than give it over to the tenant. But assuming that the landlord is willing to pass it on to the tenant, in that case, as a Muslim person, one could firstly enter into the transaction because of the need is the objective is to lease a specific property. The aspect of how the deposit is managed is more on the onus of the landlord. But
yes,
in that case, when the landlord wants to or is willing to refund the deposit together with interest accrued, in that case, as a Muslim tenant, it would not be permissible to retain that interest money. It should be given away in charity without an intention of reward. A best case scenario is to recuse oneself from even receiving it in the first place. But just keep in mind that if there's room for the landlord to misuse those funds, then it is better to take it away, receive it, and then distribute it among the poor without an intention of reward. Obviously, if the landlord is a Muslim landlord, then such a clause should not even be inserted in the first place, where
yes,
they actively take a tenant's deposit, invest it in such an avenue which accrues interest, and either retain the interest for themselves or give it over to the consumer, to the tenant. And this is purely because of being a Muslim landlord, it would not be possible to engage in such a transaction.
All right. They are, on Rajvi's talking about rentals, I know that there are new laws that have come about with regards to rental. Maybe that would be a topic that we could look at sometime. as well?
Yes, definitely. I'll make a note of it. In fact, there are a few accumulated topics now coming up. I would make a note of that specific aspect and probably try to address it in due course, inshallah.
Inshallah. Well, I just want to let you know as well that the podcasts for the shows from when we started have been put onto the website. So if you want to go back and listen to some of the very, very good economic sense that Mufti has imparted with us, I know I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to it as well as gained so much of knowledge from it. You can do that on our website. It's under Conscious Consumer. So you can look that up and you can listen to the podcast there. And inshallah, you can gain some of the valuable education that I have, and I'm sure many of the listeners who have been listening in can attest to that as well. Well, we're going to look at a call for some pragmatism to medical aids and pharmaceutical companies. I've worked in medical aid, I think, for about 10 years, mostly in training and IT, but I do understand the workings of medical aid, and I'm quite interested to hear what you are going to be discussing with us today with regards to this topic.
You know, the call for pragmatism towards medical aids and pharmaceutical companies for today's discussion is slanted towards consumer protection, is the topic of our show. I think, let me just put it into perspective here. What often happens when individuals are on chronic medication is that they, let's assume they've got a medical aid, and the medical aid subsidizes or pays for your medication once in a month. So you can have basically one supply of medication for the month, right?
Yes.
So on the one hand, you've got your medical aid, which only allows you to get one box of medication or one blister pack of medication, for example, per month. So you get this medication. But it so happens that the pharmaceutical company, on the other hand, when packaging your blister pack or even your box of medicines, they pack it in such a way that it is either 30 or 28, whereas sometimes the month is actually 31 days.
Uh-huh.
Now, if an individual is on chronic medication, that person is not suddenly okay for one day without medication. If you get what I'm saying. So on one hand, your medical aid allows you, they subsidize your medication, fine. And so you get your box of medication, but your box of medication sometimes on the side of the pharmaceutical company only has 30 or 28 tablets in it. Whereas if you really look at taking the concept of 365 days divided by 12, you'll come to about the, about 30.4, say 31. It comes up to about 31. So ideally, the pragmatic approach would be to have 31 tablets in a box, so that your medical aid is signed up for the right reason. You've got medication to cover you for your cycle of the full month, your pharmaceutical company adopts that specific practice. So this is an area where, if anyone listening has an experience, they are welcome to call us. I believe some people have a habit of, when taking the supply, they make a request to the pharmacy or provider of the medication, and they simply just insert additional one or two tablets or three tablets and take it from there. But tablets are not just tablets. Sometimes the size should not deceive us into what the value of the tablet is. One tablet could be quite exorbitant, so they wouldn't just bring additional tablets. It needs to be, and these are often issues which are regulated very stiffly by authorities. The overall management of medication is something which is under stiff regulation, and therefore I don't want to sound like the matter is very simple and easy to navigate. I'm just saying that there's a pragmatic approach here, and something is going wrong because on the one hand your medical aid is only paying for one supply of medication for the month, and on the other hand the pharmaceutical company, when packaging the material, gives you medication which is insufficient to actually run you through a full month. And while living on chronic medication, you just don't suddenly be okay for one or two days. If the month is longer than expected and your supply has run short, you're not just okay, you need medication. There is something to be looked into here. And I'm not yet sure who the right authorities are to bring this matter up with. But I think as consumers, if anyone has had the experience, they are welcome to contact us and let us know what they do. It may be a solution for someone else who doesn't have the solution. Just to be aware, I think for now the value of bringing up the matter is just for us as consumers to be conscious and aware of these kind of occurrences in our community.
Well, I do know that when chronic medication is dispensed, especially with regards to medical aid, it's usually done over a period of 3 months. So that gives the patient, and I think provincial hospitals do the same as well. When they do dispense, they give it to you for a period of 3 months, unless there's a shortage in the case of the private hospitals or with your pharmacist. So in that way, what happens is that the patient is able to maybe plan at least to make sure that they do get the rest of their medication that's due within the third month before, or maybe 2 weeks into the third month, so that they do not run short. And if they are traveling, then medical aids do allow for you to request with the doctor's certificate for a longer period of dispensing, so that you could maybe, like if you're going overseas, you could either get a script that you could possibly get the medication in the country that you're visiting, or you could actually take a 6 months supply so that you know that you are covered with regards to your medication. I'm not sure if those rules still apply, but I think it is an effective way of ensuring that your chronic medication doesn't run out and that you are covered for a period of time, and that you have time to plan so that you have you know, the rest of your supply coming in. Also, I do understand that medical aids have in place a system whereby if you are on chronic medication like diabetes, or I think in some cases hypotension, what they do is they medication is delivered to you because they belong to programs. I know a lot of medical aids have these, so that your medicine is delivered to you, and you just need to ensure that you are very aware of when, you know, your medication is going to end, so that you are knowing that you have to pick it up either from your doctor or from your pharmacy, or that it's being delivered on time to you and that the system is working. So,
you know, they say that experience is something money can't buy, and the point you made is purely a reflection of your work experience you've had in terms of the management of this kind of predicament that any person with an ailment could face. So indeed, what you say is relevant, and is a solution to many individuals who may be or may have confronted the situation where a medication does run out. I think that your point boils down to the individual also having some planning in place to make sure that medication doesn't run out, you know, because it's not possible for pharmaceutical companies or even medical aids to cover all scenarios. It's up to the consumer in the end to take some responsibility for the eventuality of medication running out. And so that eventually does rest with the consumer to be aware of your cycle, what the implications are, and how long will your medication last, or in, like as you said, in the case of traveling, how much more medication would you require so that you cannot run out and be in an adverse situation.
Yeah, I think so. Also, I stand to be corrected because I have not worked in medical aid for a long time, so things could have changed along the way. But from my understanding, I do know that that's what usually happens. But like you said, in the case of the public hospitals, patients can't really plan ahead because it depends on whether the medication is available. And in many cases, as we know, ARV drugs, if you think about it, which have to be taken on a cycle, it can't just be, you know, broken. Also, people who are on special heart medication and that kind of thing as well, also need to ensure that their medication is taken on time. And when this happens, unfortunately for them, maybe they don't even understand the implications to their health. And if it's via medical aid, then obviously to their pocket. So, like you said, sometimes a single pill could be quite expensive.
I just hope that if anyone has had any kind of circumstance of the sort, it would be nice to hear from someone on the ground in terms of how they've dealt with it, or how they encountered the specific or overcome the specific predicament.
Well, our listeners are, you are allowed to call in. You can do so on 011-854-1548, and we'd love to hear from you. Maybe you'd be able to give us a perspective that we may be not looking at, or even share your experience with us, inshallah. We'll give Mufti also a chance to understand and maybe find a solution, or even take this further as we go along. We are going to take a break right now, and inshallah, when we come back, we'll deal with our fourth topic, which is also one that I think is very, very relevant to us and something that we need to be educated upon. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. We are talking Conscious Consumer with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji, and inshallah, we are on our last topic. We won't be spending too much time on this topic, but let's see how far we can go. What does the profile of an excellent consumer look like in the eyes of the credit bureau? Interesting. I want to hear this because I have many people who've been asking questions with regards to this, as I've said before.
Well, you know, the issue of what the profile of an excellent consumer looks like in the eyes of the credit bureau is something that is also interesting to myself. But before I go on to the three key points that need to be made in terms of the profile of an excellent consumer, allow me to just talk about why does credit score matter so much in this day and age. Because we have discussed credit scores in the past.
Yes.
It may occur to someone that we repeatedly bring it up. It's just that, keep in mind, we're trying to bring in different angles of the credit score. Be that as it may, I think the aspect which is pressing is the issue of why is the credit score so important in this day and age. And it all boils down to how the modern world views engagement in debt. We are living in a world where debt is viewed as, some forms of debt are being viewed as healthy debt, which from an Islamic perspective is questionable. It is there, there are conceptual basis for healthy debt in Islamic commerce, but this is the reality of the world we live in. The second component mm-hmm. of the world we live in regarding debt is that in order to build up a credit score or to get credit, a person has to be involved in credit. You have to be having some cycle of credit in order to get credit. So even if you want a simple thing like a mobile phone contract, you need to have to be able to show some kind of credit history. So this is the reality of the world we're living in, and this is why discussion of the credit score and how credit bureaus approach dealing with our credit score is concerned is important. Allow me to just go into the first aspect. The first aspect I want to talk about is responding to your question of what the profile of an excellent consumer looks like. Now, the first aspect in terms of the excellent profile is that there are no retail or clothing accounts, which I know many individuals tend to have. Edgar, Jet, Woolworths, does that, you know, so many sometimes. But in the profile of an excellent consumer is not to have any retail or clothing accounts, because this one is regarded as an element of overspending and not being able to manage one's own funds. That is why one has to have these credit lines at different stores. So this is the first component of an excellent profile of a consumer. The second aspect is that in a 24-month payment cycle, there is only a maximum of one late payment on a credit card. And this is because it's still part of an excellent credit profile, because sometimes people forget to make a payment innocently. They have funds, they just innocently forget to make a payment. So forgetting one or two payments doesn't really affect the credit score of a consumer. And this is why in a 24-month cycle, the credit bureau views one or two as a tolerable limit in a 24-month cycle. The third aspect is the issue of the number of inquiries on your profile. So you as a consumer, as you're living your life, many people, as you apply for credit to, say, banks, or you want to buy a house or a car or even a cell phone contract, there are numerous inquiries on your profile. So sometimes your landlord is making an inquiry on your profile. If he's a really astute landlord and he knows how to manage a tenant, he would do this. So the number of inquiries on your profile is tracked by the credit bureau. And if your the number of inquiries does not exceed four, it is still fine. Within a 12-month cycle, it's still acceptable in the eyes of the credit bureau or any other provider of credit. They would look at this aspect. If there are too many inquiries on your profile, it is a signal that this particular consumer is in difficulty and not able to service debt. And the fourth and final aspect in terms of the profile of an excellent consumer is that the credit utilization on their credit card does not exceed 35%. So if your credit card allows you for X amount of spending, then you do not exceed 35% of their spending at any given point in time. This is a point of a signal to any credit provider that this consumer is a good consumer and able to manage their finances. So many times you find people just maxing out the credit cards and they say, I'll settle it at the end of the month in full. Yes, you can do it, but repeated revealing of utilizing more than 35% of your credit allocation on your cards is a point that to any credit provider that you've actually you're not in a position to manage credits responsibly. So this is the first aspect, the profile of an excellent consumer, and I hope it responds adequately to your question. There are two more points that I'll just wait for your feedback and insight into the matter of the profile of an excellent consumer.
Okay, Jazakallah khair. I think that really explains, you know, part of the question, but we will, inshallah, speak to you again next week and get more on that particular topic, because I think there is more to it that you would like to discuss as well. But unfortunately, we've come to the end of today's show, and Jazakallah khair for your time, and we'll speak to you next week, inshallah.
Inshallah, definitely. I look forward to it. Yes, we can look at the aspects of how to improve the score and also some of the effects and myths regarding credit bureaus and management of credit. Jazakallah khair for having me, and I look forward to future segments, inshallah.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum. Well, there you have it. That's our show for this morning. And I hope it's been educational and enlightening and empowering for you, because I certainly gain a lot from, especially from all the different topics that we deal with. And alhamdulillah, if you'd like to give feedback, you're most welcome through to send your feedback through to the station manager or to Radio Islam, and let us know what it is that you would like to have on the show. The show is for our listeners at the end of the day. And I do appreciate the listeners listening in and giving their feedback. It allows us to grow and be better in what we do. And Jazakallah khair from me. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.